authority, superior power. Think how Mitch McConnell denying Obama a Supreme Court appointment has changed everything. And look how Trump and the Repubs have accelerated the avalanche to collapse and bury the judicial system, the fundamental rule of law. Trump claiming his own re-election was part of his job as president, if approved by the courts, means everything the president does is part of his power, even what he does on his gold-plated commode. Can enough Americans still agree on something? For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, August 23rd, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes David Rosenberg, Dan Raphael, and Paul Kim. The producer is Grant Button, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Mike Moen, Antonia Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, Roz Brown, and the inimitable Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomas on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. That is great folks like you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, please go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for news in depth. And
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm speaking with Jeremiah Hayden from Street Roots about his new article. It's called Coming Down the Pipe: Newly Obtained Records Add Fuel to Critics' Fire Over Portland Officials' Private Interactions with Zenith Energy. Welcome, Jeremiah.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to speak with us today. So your new article exposes quite a bit about the process behind Portland approving permits for the fossil fuel company Zenith Energy after years of denying their requests. You uncovered a lot in these public records that I want to get into here, but I kind of want to start by getting everybody up to speed. Can you take me through the timeline of interactions between Zenith and the city of Portland leading up to this Oregon Supreme Court decision last fall?
Yeah, Zenith purchased an old asphalt terminal in 2017. It had been there since 1947. And they purchased that asphalt terminal, and then, but they had already been running their operations through the terminal since 2014. Then in 2019, Portland denied Zenith a franchise agreement request. They were trying to build three new pipes beneath Front Avenue. Portland denied that on the condition that they didn't know for sure that Zenith would not be transporting fossil fuels. So Zenith withdrew that request then, and then in January 2021, DEQ said it would require a land use compatibility statement, or a LUX, and the city denied that renewal request in August of 2021. So Zenith immediately appealed to the Land Use Board of Appeals, that's the state level, LUBA, and things went kind of back and forth with litigation for a little while. In June of 2022, Zenith appealed to the Oregon Supreme Court, and that was an open case until Commissioner Dan Ryan's Bureau of Development Services issued a new LUX permit on October 3rd, 2022. 3 days later, the Supreme Court decided to not hear the appeal, which would have left in place the previous decision saying that the city of Portland had the right to deny that permit.
Why was Portland denying permits to Zenith in the first place? There was a lot of public pressure on the risk that Zenith poses to the community.
The city of Portland basically said that this LUX ran contrary to their comprehensive plan to get off of fossil fuels. The city has been doing a lot over the last few years to try to get away from fossil fuels in the interest of addressing climate change. And they weren't certain that that approving this permit would actually appease, native groups along the Willamette River, tribal nations who have access to water rights and stuff like that. So it didn't align with the city's vision for the future of Portland.
And what kind of risks were advocates identifying of Zenith and the expansion that they were wanting to do?
It's much like a lot of oil by rail or storage tanks or pipelines. It's emissions, CO2 emissions in the face of catastrophic climate change, pollutants directly, into the river. And oil by rail, as we've seen in like Mosier in 2018, a train derailed and it was, it explodes and, leaks into the river. One of the major things that activists and advocates bring up about this particular event at the Energy Infrastructure Hub where Zenith is located is the risk of an earthquake. And Multnomah County released a report in 2022 about the potential for devastating on the scale of the BP oil spill effects in the event of an earthquake off the Oregon coast in the Cascadia subduction zone.
So to get back to the timeline, thank you for explaining that. The Oregon Supreme Court upholds the appeals court decision that Portland has the right to deny Zenith this land use permit. Like you said, 3 days before that decision actually comes down, Commissioner Dan Ryan's Bureau of Development Services granted a new land use permit to Zenith, and this was pretty shocking at the time, given how popular the permit denial had been. You found evidence for what was leading up to that decision, which kind of felt like it came out of nowhere from the public perspective. What were Portland leaders doing before this decision?
Yeah, the records that we obtained show a pretty close communication between elected officials, more with their staff, not with Commissioners Dan Ryan or Carmen Rubio specifically, although they are included in a lot of these emails and communications, but with their staff and city attorneys, speaking with members of, Zenith, high level officials, and also the PAC West, which is Zenith's public relations firm. There are text messages and emails ongoing, as early as February is when Zenith's officials reached out, and then, ongoing, until today, honestly. This story sort of circles around July 29th tour, which PAC West, the PR firm, invited city officials to go down to the infrastructure hub where their facilities are to take a tour so that they could sell the city on the idea of turning that area into a renewable fuels hub for the West Coast.
There's a quote from your article that I want to add in here. You write, quote, "Despite concerns and ongoing litigation, the Portland Bureau of Development Services, or BDS, approved a new LUX permit on October 3rd, 2022, after city officials tasked with public oversight engaged Zenith in private meetings, conversations on a boat tour sponsored by Working Waterfront Coalition, and coordinated public messaging," according to the report, to the records, excuse me.
Right. The boat tour, yeah, there's a Working Waterfront Coalition boat tour, and Zenith's chief operations officer, Grady Reamer, said in an email that he intended to be on that boat tour and knew that Commissioner Ryan was going to be there and intended to talk with him about this permit at that tour. The coordinated public messaging part comes a little bit later in September, just a few days before the October 3rd announcement of the LUX approval, in which BDS Director Rebecca Isau sent a text to Grady Reamer alerting him to the fact that it was going to take an extra day for them to issue that permit.
One of the things that this sort of centers around is that Zenith has been saying that it'll use this infrastructure for renewable fuels. And you spoke to some advocates who say that renewable fuels are really not that much different from fossil fuels. And what Zenith saying that they're going to do renewable fuels rather than fossil fuels is substantially similar. What is the distinction there that kind of motivates this?
I think there's a whole other story to be written here about this specifically, but generally, from what I learned talking with advocates like Nick Caleb from the Breach Collective and Audrey Leonard, an attorney at Columbia Riverkeeper, renewable fuels are identical chemically or similar in some cases to regular fossil fuel diesel. So the dangers associated with earthquakes or explosions or fires, all of these things are generally the same. Renewable fuels are made from things like soybeans, corn. Sometimes they will clear out palm oil. So importing from Singapore, which seems to be a part of this renewable fuels plan for the city, you know, it's worth asking where the feedstocks are coming from to create these renewable fuels, because it might just cancel out the gains in a reduction of carbon emissions that the city is trying to do. With that said, there are significant benefits to renewable fuels at the point where they are burned. So a truck burning renewable diesel is significantly better than burning traditional fossil fuels, but that's only at that point of combustion. And there are a lot of open questions about whether or not the production process actually does anything to benefit the material effects of climate change.
So perhaps an interpretation could be that the city's reversal hinges on this idea of Zenith doing renewable fuels rather than fossil fuels, and there's this sort of phase-out aspect of it as well. But you also write that contains a loophole for Zenith in that agreement. Can you talk to me about that?
Yeah, one of the records that we found was a email from now Carmen Rubio's chief of staff, Jillian Schoen, who emailed Zenith's Grady Reamer to kind of talk about this, and saying that the ban on fossil fuels will happen over time as supply grows, the supply of renewable diesel that would be blended with traditional fossil fuels. And she said, but we do need to move away from fossil fuel diesel, and renewable diesel is that answer. There is a provision in the draft policy to pay close attention to supply and adjust as required, which the people that I asked interpret, and as I did, as if there is not enough supply of renewable diesel, because it's a blended percentage that goes into traditional fossil fuels, if there's not enough supply of renewables, then essentially they need to continue to provide what they do now, which is fossil fuels. They are a fossil fuel transportation and storage company.
There's also another agreement that you write was discreetly signed to allow Zenith to install two additional pipes under Northwest Front Avenue. What can you tell me about that decision?
Yeah, when Zenith, after they purchased the asphalt terminal in 2017, they applied for a new franchise agreement in 2019. They wanted to build three new pipes beneath Northwest Front Avenue. It's like literally like one block off of the Willamette River. They were denied that request because it ran contrary to the city's determination that fossil fuels pose a risk to safety, health, and livability. That kind of went away, and that was seen as a huge victory for environmental advocates. But I started asking around, and through the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, someone sent me a signed letter of agreement between the BPS director, that's the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, Donnie Oliveira, and Grady Reamer, Zenith's COO. And that was dated on July 31st. That is essentially in a letter of agreement. So there's been no change to the official franchise agreement, but this is a letter that will allow them to install two additional pipes. There are some provisions saying that it must be renewable. There are some like enforcement mechanisms that are put in place. with that said, coupled with the idea of paying attention to supply, it's hard to tell if those will actually effectively be used only for renewable fuels in 5 years, as Zenith has promised.
With all of this in mind, where do the Zenith permits and construction plans stand now?
So now that Zenith has their Lux permit, they, in November 2022, they applied for a lower tier DEQ permit, which essentially brings down the amount of pollutants and emissions that they are allowed to emit. DEQ is currently drafting that permit, according to DEQ spokesperson Harry Estive. And that is going to include a 35-day public comment period. So they're on their way to getting their air quality permit, which was the point of needing to get this new revised Lux. And so they're on pace to do business moving forward.
Were there things in this reporting process that you were surprised by?
I was surprised to see that there, after so many conversations and public comments that were strikingly similar, I was a bit surprised to see how much communication, really friendly, direct, like text messaging and kind of quiet communication there was between city officials and staff and a public relations firm. It's easy to forget this is a public relations firm. They're PacWest. The idea is that it's an advertising agency. And I was kind of surprised to see that the city officials who were in a position to win in court based on how the city had been moving, you know, in a certain direction for a couple of years, I was surprised to see that they kind of bought into this advertising agency's plan, you know, so quickly and so consistently over a few months.
What do you hope that listeners and readers take away from this story?
Sometimes these things can be extremely boring. Something like a land use compatibility statement, you know, there might be 14 people who are in the city of Portland who are really interested in something like that. But these really minute decisions actually have significant impacts when we're talking about explosions into neighborhoods. You know, something we didn't even get into is what the demographics are in the neighborhoods through which these oil by rail trains, you know, go through, and the emissions just from not only the operations right on the Willamette River, but how they come into our community in the first place and what communities are in those places. I think that the impact that this has on, honestly, a lot of the same types of, you know, demographics of people who are significantly impacted by other types of violence in our world. You know, it makes something like a Lux permit not all that boring and actually quite significant.
If listeners are interested, how can they read your work for themselves?
The best way to get Street Roots is to buy it from a vendor, particularly after such a hot and smoky week last week. It can be difficult for people to get out and sell papers. Highly recommend buying a paper. You can find that at streetroots.org. There is a list of areas where vendors are. It's also online, streetroots.org.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up here? Anything we didn't get to mention?
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. That was Jeremiah Hayden from Street Roots speaking with me about his new article, Coming Down the Pipe, Newly Obtained Records Add Fuel to Critics' Fire Over Portland Officials' Private Interactions with Zenith Energy. More information is available at streetroots.org. You've been listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for being with us.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. The recent assassinations of Ecuadorian presidential candidate and anti-corruption crusader Fernando Villavicencio and political leader Pedro Briones are indicative of what Ecuador has been facing over the last 3 years. Jake Johnston is a senior research associate at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg before the first round of Ecuador's 2023 presidential election.
So the assassination of this presidential candidate, the family says it's a state crime. It sounds like there's pretty big evidence for that. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, well, I think we can talk about a few different things. I mean, one of just the specifics of the attack itself, right? This happened as the candidate was leaving a campaign rally. They exited through the front door as opposed to the side entrance into the parking lot, which another candidate, a former police officer, did do, right, and avoided any of this activity. And then there's the car. The car was not a bulletproof or armored vehicle, despite the campaign having that. Again, campaigns are provided with security from the state, right? So this was a state that was responsible for the provision of this security. I think also concerning is the fact that, when the candidate was ushered into the car, he was ushered in there alone. There were no police that entered the vehicle with him. And the opposite flank of the car where the shots were actually fired, the fatal shots were fired, was totally unprotected by the security detail. And so, again, given the state's role in providing security to the candidates, these, circumstances are obviously extremely troubling.
What's going on here? There have been many more killings, right? Why is Ecuador in this situation right now?
Yeah, well, I think we could talk about a few things there. I mean, one, right, is you have to understand Ecuador is sandwiched right between Colombia and Peru, right, the two largest cocaine producers in the world. And as the supply chains have shifted and as the routes north have been increasingly dominated by fentanyl, Ecuador has turned into an extremely important transshipment point for cocaine, especially with European destinations. It has a number of large port cities on its Pacific coast that service these areas and have become increasingly, key parts of this transshipment network. The other thing has been a total collapse of state institutions and the economy in recent years. We've seen Ecuador, after many years of positive economic growth and tremendous social progress, really turn in a different direction under the last two administrations and implement a broad neoliberal policy associated with the International Monetary Fund, slashing public salaries and public workforces. And this has really led to a deterioration in sort of the general conditions in the country. And I think that's important context, right? I mean, that is also part of the explanation of what drives insecurity. I think what we've seen in more recent weeks and months with these high-level political assassinations, but it also just shows the extent to which organized crime groups, narco-trafficking, and criminal organizations have infiltrated the state and have a stake in the outcome of these elections, right?
So this is worse, would you say, than what was going on in Colombia for many years, with all the killings, the right-wing paramilitaries, the drug cartels, etc.?
I don't know if it's worse than Colombia in its sort of heyday of violence, right? But I think it's certainly drawn comparisons to that, right? It's hard not to make such note, especially again with the prevalence of the narcotics trafficking organizations.
The corruption that exists in Ecuador, is that because of the drug trafficking, or did that exist before that really started in a big way?
Well, look, I mean, certainly corruption, I think, is endemic just about in every country, right? It's there's different forms and fashions in which it takes. But we've seen a big increase in recent years, certainly in this. And these are allegations that have touched not just the government more broadly, but the president, Guillermo Lasso, himself. And so there were allegations which emerged from some investigative reporting earlier this year, focusing on one of Lasso's closest business associates and a man who also happens to be his brother-in-law, Danilo Carrera. And evidence had emerged that President Lasso had intervened to stop an anti-narcotics investigation because it would have implicated this his brother-in-law, Carrera, and specifically one of Carrera's close associates, a man named Ruben Cheres. And so this was actually largely sort of part of the basis of the impeachment trial that was making its way through the parliament earlier this year, and what led Guillermo Lasso to dissolve the Congress and call these snap elections for this weekend. So I think we have to understand that the reason why these elections are happening right now is because of the allegations of high-level government complicity with criminal activity, right? And I think, you know, important to note that these assassinations, they've touched political leaders more recently, but this individual, Ruben Cheres, who was expected to be a key witness in the Lasso impeachment trial, was also assassinated earlier this year. And so certainly I think it's hard not to make the connections between all of the, you know, political associations and connections and the increasing levels of violence that we've seen in recent months.
So the candidate the most recently who was assassinated, he was running on an anti-corruption platform, right? Do you think that had an effect on how certain people viewed him, that they felt like they had to get rid of this guy, that he was a major threat to them somehow?
Look, you know, I mean, I think it's impossible to know exactly what the motivations are, but certainly, you know, it's impossible not to make those connections, right? He had been a vocal critic of high-level government corruption and in complicity and sort of documenting the ties between state security forces and these criminal elements. In fact, one of his final interviews before the assassination specifically focused on that, you know, where he said the police know where these criminals are, right? They're not acting. And that he pledged to purge the police force of these corrupt actors if he reached the presidency. So again, you know, this is something he had been involved in for quite some time. He also was involved in this investigation into Lasso's business associate that I mentioned earlier as well. So he's been involved in a number of extremely high profile cases in recent months and years.
Do you think there's going to be a serious investigation of this assassination?
There have been some arrests. I think one really concerning fact is that the one gunman who was captured in the immediate aftermath of the attack, who was injured rather than being brought to the hospital, was not, and ended up dying in police custody, right? So our one sort of eyewitness is no longer there. Now, other individuals, six Colombians who are allegedly part of, you know, a narco-trafficking organization have been detained, but very little information has come out. Ecuador has requested the assistance of the FBI, which is now apparently on the ground and assisting in the investigation. But I think, you know, there are a lot of reasons to question what information is really going to come out and what the results of this investigation are going to be. And certainly, you know, we're not going to get answers before this weekend's election. And the crime and the rising insecurity is certainly playing a role in that process as well.
How would you describe the political landscape in Ecuador in terms of left and right? Is there a strong left in the country, for example?
Yeah, indeed, right? And the major progressive political party is the party of former President Rafael Correa. Their candidate, Luisa Gonzalez, is first in the polls and has been first in the polls for some time in the run-up to this weekend's election. Now, you know, we don't have an excellent picture of the impact of these recent attacks on polling, but every indication is that she has been the candidate most hurt by this attack in terms of her electoral viability. And I think the largest reason is because of the sort of focus on insecurity has led to sort of the rise of some other candidates who have really sort of put that front and center in their campaign. And key among those is an individual, Jan Topic, who is a businessman, a government contractor in Ecuador, but also somebody who runs a private security business, who touts his time as a paramilitary, including in the French Foreign Legion, and has sort of drawn comparisons to Bukele in El Salvador in terms of, you know, their iron-fisted approach to crime. You know, an interesting dynamic here is also because he is the owner of a private security company, he's actually doing quite well as insecurity has risen in Ecuador. His company is expanding quite a bit.
What's the U.S. role in Ecuador, if any? Could you talk about that?
Yes, certainly. So, you know, the Lasso government was seen as a really important ally for the United States in the region, one of the only conservative governments remaining as this sort of, you know, wave of progressivism has reemerged in the continent, right? And so Lasso and the Ecuadorian government were seen as extremely important allies, and there was a lot of effort to sort of strengthen that relationship. And even as these, again, allegations and details around high-level government corruption and complicity were coming out, you know, there were high-level meetings. Senators were traveling down to Ecuador, meeting with Lasso, supporting it as an impeachment process. And so he's received tremendous support from the United States government throughout his administration.
You can't really know, but any speculation as to what might happen in the near future?
There's a lot of questions, right? I mean, I think what we've seen is, again, you know, the political violence is continuing. And, you know, the expectation is that there will not be an outright winner in Sunday's snap election, that we're likely headed to a second round, which will be held in October. You know, and I think that indicates that the sort of, you know, pall of insecurity and fear will hang over the rest of this electoral process.
That's Jake Johnston of the Center for Economic and Policy Research speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg. And we should say that it looks like Ecuador's presidential election is headed to a runoff between left-wing candidate Luisa Gonzalez and businessman Daniel Noboa in October. This has been KABU News in Depth. I'm Reed Johnson. Thanks for listening.
Episode of Voices for the Animals, we'll look into the case of a goat, a girl, and the rise of more compassionate and humane alternatives to 4-H agricultural programs. We'll be speaking with Danielle Hanisch, Executive Director of LEAP, Leaders for Ethics, Animals, and the Planet. It's a program that offers students the farm animal care experience and opportunities of 4-H without the selling of those animals for slaughter, which can traumatize many kids.
These kids were, 14, 15, 16 years old and just realizing, like someone flipped a switch that, oh my gosh, these animals are no different than my dogs and cats at home. They have feelings, they have personalities. And now I'm knee deep in this program and I don't think that there's another option and I have to betray my friend who I have cared for.
Got your goat on the next Voices for the Animals, airing Friday, August 25th.